Drawing room over here.
Oh, hey, come on in. As a senior partner at Arnold Bloch Leibler, Mark Leibler has represented some of Australia's richest business people. He's talked to pretty much every political leader in recent memory, even been friends with some of them. He's an influential leader in the Jewish community in Australia and internationally. But what's the story behind that? Michael Gawenda is a distinguished journalist, including a long stint as editor at The Age newspaper. His new book, The Power Broker, looks at the life of Mark Leibler. And Mark and Michael are my guests in the drawing room. Firstly, I've got to say, Michael Gawenda, you've beaten me to it. This was one of my book ideas, so good on you. What a great idea.
You can always do a different version, you know.
No, there's only
a completely different result.
Tell me, why did you want to tell Mark's story?
I'd kicked around a number of ideas with a friend of mine, Louise Adler, who was the MUP publisher at the time, and she actually brought up this idea, why not consider a biography of Mark Leibler? He's interesting, he's powerful, he's connected, he's, you know. And then I remembered that years ago I had actually run across Mark when I was running the Centre for Advancing Journalism at Melbourne University. I'd run across him at the university, just, you know, we crossed paths. And I had said to him in passing, you should write an autobiography. You've got an interesting story to tell. I think he laughed it off at the time. And we both forgot about it, I think. I did, certainly, until Louise raised it. But when I thought about it, I thought two things. One, it will give me the opportunity to examine the way power and influence works in Australia, which has always interested me. It should interest every journalist, and certainly journalists like you, Patricia, covering politics. That was the first thing. And the second thing was that it would give me a chance, after all these years of being a journalist and a writer, to actually write something that had to do with the fact that I was Jewish. It would give me a chance to examine a Jewish life that was totally different than my Jewish life in all sorts of ways, but that would immerse me again in looking at, you know, what it meant to be a Jew, what the Jewish community was about, what the Jewish community in which we were both raised was about, and that's why I did it.
Mark, why did you decide to be part of the book? Why didn't ask for this, you know, you didn't come up with the idea. You could have made Michael's job a lot harder by staying silent. That's what some people do. Why did you agree to speak?
Well, you know, I embarked upon this with a great deal of trepidation. This is not an authorised biography, which means that I really had no say whatsoever in terms of what Michael was going to write. But given that he was going to do a book, after thinking it through, I decided, you know, the best way of approaching this is to cooperate, which means that I gave many interviews. I didn't talk people out of having interviews with Michael. And I figured out that although I hadn't known Michael well, after quite a bit of interaction with him, I came to the conclusion that he would at least be fair and objective in doing the book. And over and above all of that, my younger boy, who happens to be a partner of mine, Jeremy, was absolutely determined that I should do this book. And by the way, for the right reasons, not because that the Australian people would be so interested, but it was part of the legacy that I should leave to my children and grandchildren and whoever's going to come after them. So, you know, when you put all of that together, I decided that I would do this. But again, as I said, it was with a great deal of trepidation.
Both of your parents migrated to Australia because of World War II and, you know, this sort of the post-Holocaust era. What was your experience growing up in Melbourne at that time, Mark?
I didn't know many people who were not Jewish at the time, hardly any. I went to a Jewish day school. I went to my local synagogue. I was brought up within a, you know, pretty sheltered sort of framework. It was, you know, my horizons really only started broadening and very substantially when I entered university and thereafter. So, you know, the early years, you know, from those early years, there's one incident that it's a strange thing because I don't remember, you know, that much from when I was very young. But so this would goes back to the early 50s. You know, my parents were pretty modest, middle class. They used to drive a Holden car in those days, General Motors. I still remember, you know, more or less what the car looked like. But one day I turned up from school, young kid, and I saw this beautiful Jaguar parked in the driveway. And it was only later that I discovered that what had happened was that my parents had gone back to my mother's parents' house before the Holocaust, and my mother's parents were murdered at Auschwitz, and they discovered hidden in the brickwork there in their old home a cache of diamonds. So they brought them back to Australia, bought a car. My father liked beautiful things, beautiful cars. And so that was a Jaguar that I saw in the driveway. But I got to tell you, it didn't take too long. We were back to Holden's again.
Michael, your family were of a different political persuasion to Mark's. Do those politics mean anything growing up? Were you part of that community, that life, that political thinking?
Look, I had an entirely different experience to Mark. My parents came here in 1949. I was born in a displaced persons camp in Austria. My mother and father and my two elder sisters escaped Poland to Russia, spent the war years in the Soviet Union, in Siberia, basically, and made their way eventually to Australia. They were my father, my mother not so much. My mother was a more traditional Jewish person. She kept the Shabbat and she kept a kosher home. But my father was a militant secularist, a socialist. He was a supporter of the Labor Party and a member of the Labor Party in Australia. I grew up in a youth organisation, a Jewish youth organisation that was a socialist Jewish organisation. We were not Zionists, but we were very immersed in what it meant to be Jewish. I grew up loving Yiddish language and culture. I studied with my father and at a Sunday school, Jewish history, Jewish ethics, religion in the Torah in a non-religious form as a secular study. And I didn't go to a Jewish school. And most of my friends growing up, certainly my father and mother had a milk bar in Fitzroy for some years. There were no Jewish people in Fitzroy. I went to the local state school. I grew up with lots of migrant kids, Greek kids, kids from Yugoslavia. My best friend was a Greek boy, but not within a Jewish community. I think that's true.
And that really alters, I think, your perspective based on, you know, where you grow up and those early experiences. Mark, you've said that your father was an influence on your ambitions, but that your mother was sort of the larger influence on your life. Tell me about your mother. What was Rachel like?
She was a very ardent Zionist. And the one thing that she always emphasised was the importance of education, a secular education and a Jewish education. And that's why she was very supportive of the Jewish day school movement. She herself, both here in Australia and internationally, was very much involved in top leadership positions in what's called the religious Zionist organisation, a worldwide organisation with branches here in Australia and in other countries throughout the world. It was called Emunah. Before that, it was called Mizrahi. She was the president of that here, and then she had a very senior role at an international level. She frequently travelled to Israel. She was an ardent Zionist. She imbued that in her children, myself and my two brothers. She was a bigger influence on my life because I was only 14 when my father died. So obviously she then lived the rest of her life essentially for her children. She was an incredibly dedicated mother.
If you're just tuning in, this is RN. I'm Patricia Carvalis, and joining me in the drawing room are Michael Gawenda and Mark Liebler, and we're talking about Mark's life and the new biography, The Power Broker. So, Mark, you know, you embarked on what was really an amazing career, but let's get to the power broker stuff, right? Because you are, okay. You're incredibly connected, and that's how I know you. We know each other really well, and that's through your work in politics, in advocacy on Indigenous affairs. Before I ask you why, I want to get to Michael Gawenda and something he said a little earlier to me, which was that, you know, he thinks journalists, political journalists, should get behind why people are interested in power. What did you find out about Mark Liebler and power and the way he uses power and the way that he connects with these influential people, Michael Gawenda?
Well, I think that if I could sum it up, I'd say this, that I came to understand that the exercise of power and influence is not simple, that it's not just a matter of trying to lobby people to take on a particular position, that it requires an understanding of the person with whom you're trying to form a relationship in order to discuss issues that are of interest to you and that this person can influence. And I think Mark was brilliant at understanding and preparing for the relationships he was forming. I think that's a key lesson that I got out of the research of how he operated in terms of power and influence. The second thing was that he was straight with people. I think that's incredibly important. He didn't overpraise them. He didn't obfuscate. He never did any of those things, and which meant that he came to people who were busy and powerful and had agendas. He came to them and they felt like they were dealing with someone who was smart, who understood the way politics operated, and that crucially had something to offer them.
Mark, how do you reflect on that?
I tend to agree with quite a bit of what Michael just had to say. Look, I think it's critically important, whether it's a politician, whether it's a senior tax official, or whoever it is, you've got to think like them. You've got to put yourself in their position. You've got to understand, you know, what they're likely to be attracted to and what they're not likely to be attracted to. The other thing is that you've got to learn to put propositions. If you want something, the argument's got to be put in a simple form that a politician is going to have the time to absorb and to understand and to act on. Because if you don't do it that way, if it becomes overcomplicated, then it ends up in the hands of bureaucrats, many of whom specialise in making things more complicated than they need to be so that they can retain control over the agenda. It's a sort of yes minister type of thing, if you understand what I'm saying.
I get what you mean. You've been a community leader and prominent lawyer, both from a fairly young age. Did you see these as complementary roles, or were they parts of your life that you needed to keep apart?
They ended up by being complementary roles, but not deliberately so. In other words, I think what Michael points out is that they became intertwined in the sense that I guess relationships that I developed as a lawyer were of help in advancing Jewish community concerns, were of help in advancing Indigenous issues, and vice versa. So that wasn't a matter of design. Like, for example, in our legal practice, we put a lot of emphasis on, you know, pro bono work, particularly in the Indigenous space, but in a whole range of other issues as well too. So the answer is what we discovered was that that was attractive to clients. It was attractive to staff who came to work for us, but they were interests that we embarked upon for their own sake, because it was the right thing to do, because we felt the need to give back. And it was only after that we discovered that, in fact, they had all these consequences. And the same thing applies in relation to my sort of different roles and different areas of life. They did complement each other, but they were not embarked upon because there was any thought that, you know, one would enhance the other.
Michael, reading the book, this side of politics feels like it's been tougher to navigate. It's more personal and perhaps more complicated than tax law. Is that what you found from, you know, looking at Mark's life?
Well, I think that his interactions on tax law are incredibly interesting because they've never, that kind of interaction, the way, for instance, a major tax lawyer like Mark might interact with the tax office, I haven't seen anyone ever write about that. I think it's incredibly interesting. And the responses of the senior people that he dealt with are really interesting. But I do think that he dealt with them in not too much of a different fashion, even though I don't know that he formed friendships with senior tax people. But I think he dealt with them in virtually the same way as he did with the politicians he came to deal with, prime ministers, senior treasurers over a long period of time. I think the skills he had in dealing with them were the same skills he had and used dealing in that tax law area.
Mark, Michael has described you as playing your politics hard. Do you think that's fair? Is it necessary to be hard to get things done?
Well, it's not really necessary to be hard. In my earlier years, I was, on some occasions a little bit more aggressive than was necessary under the circumstances. Although I've got to say, sometimes to get results, you do have to play it hard. But I think I've mellowed a bit.
Have you? Since then.
You know, it's quite interesting. If you read the book and you read the chapters that deal with my interactions with the tax office, there are complaints occasionally from people at, more grassroots level that I was engaged in bullying. But it's interesting that the senior people who Michael interviewed, including the immediate former Commissioner of Taxation, make a point of saying that they never felt bullied by me. And the form of bullying that's actually alleged against me is that I actually indicated that I would be prepared to escalate this and to deal with more senior tax officials if they weren't prepared to listen to reasonable argument. Now, in my books, that's not bullying, but it's quite apparent the senior tax officials were sensitive to those sort of concerns among their staff, and so obviously that's something that I needed to understand and to be sensitive to as well.
One of the things about your sort of life, Mark, and Michael Gwender, you explore this, is the kind of social justice work you've done too, particularly your leadership in Indigenous affairs. Michael Gwender, did you want to explore that part also of Mark Liebler's work? He's been very much one of the very senior business leaders who has given his gravitas to what is a very important movement.
Well, I must say that one of the reasons why I decided to take to write this biography was that I had some knowledge of the work Mark had done in this Indigenous area. And for me, I wanted to explore that because I thought Mark Liebler is not the cardboard cutout that a lot of people have suggested he is. He's not just a leading tax lawyer. He's not just a leader of the Jewish community. He's not just a friend and an acquaintance of the influential and wealthy. He is more than that. And his life and his views can't be summed up easily. I think he's a complex character. I think there are contradictions in Mark Liebler's life, as there are in everyone once you start exploring it. But in some ways, I was most taken in the research by the way Mark came to get involved in Indigenous issues, the way that this basically conservative man, conservative in some ways, not in all ways, who was 50, had no real knowledge of Indigenous Australia, hadn't thought about it much, hadn't learnt much about it at school, suddenly that whole world opened up for him for a number of reasons, one of which, of course, was that Noel Pearson came to do his articles and work at ABL, how that opened up, and I think it transformed his life. I think it transformed the way he saw himself as an Australian, as a Jew, and as a leader in Australia and not just in the Jewish community.
Mark, is that a fair assessment? What you've become now very passionate about Indigenous affairs. What is your connection to those issues and why is this such an important area for you to show leadership in?
Well, it's a combination of factors. And I think Michael is pretty right. I mean, the involvement in the Yorta Yorta case, for the first time I began to appreciate Native Title and the issues thrown up by Native Title. I was quite mesmerised by the Mabo case. But I think the real turning point came when Noel Pearson came to our firm and was articled to me. He's a very special human being. He's got the most remarkable intellect. I think I said elsewhere that my one regret was that he didn't take up Paul Keating, who was Prime Minister at the time, Paul Keating's offer to, you know, take a seat in the Parliament. I really believe that Noel Pearson could have been our first Indigenous Prime Minister. But the other thing, once I came to understand all these things, you know, Australia is just about one of the best countries in the world that anyone can live in today. And by the way, we're seeing this notwithstanding all our suffering as Melburnians, even during this pandemic. Look at us and look what's happening elsewhere in the world today. And this wonderful country of ours, you know, we have our Indigenous people who live in under conditions that are worse than, you know, third world countries. It's just a terrible blot on our country. We started off by murdering our Indigenous people, killing them with kindness, and then working out that the best thing for them was, you do what we tell you to do. Now, I think nowadays we're coming to the realisation that this has to be a partnership. We have to work together and Indigenous people have to take more and more responsibility for looking after their own affairs, self-determination. But notwithstanding, this is a terrible blot on our society.
How much of your connection, though, to that has been based on understanding the importance of culture and, I suppose, understanding it for the links that it has, I suppose, to your own Jewish identity?
Well, you preempted what I was going to say. And the next matter that I was going to refer to, look, the Jewish people know all about suffering. They know about pogroms, being the Holocaust recently. So we understand what all of that means. So it's not surprising that we should be particularly sensitive to, you know, those who've been through such deprivation and have had to suffer the way our Indigenous people have had to suffer. We, you know, the key is education. If you get education right, then you will get the right health consequence. You'll get employment. You'll get the incarceration rates will go down. There are ways of solving this situation, but it will be only solved if Indigenous people themselves are at the centre of it and not being told to do what to do by white bureaucrats. And you can't have a situation where 80% of the money is being spent on white bureaucrats, and, you know, what's left over goes directly to our Aboriginal Australians. There has to be a sea change.
Thank you to both of you for talking to me. I know it's not an easy time for anyone at the moment, but this is just such an important book, and I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Patricia.
Yes, thank you, Patricia.
Mark Liebler and Michael Gwenda there. They've been my guests in The Drawing Room. The Power Broker is out now through Monash University Publishing.